Ms. Alvarado.
Yes, thank you, board. This is Kristen Rogier, and this is the challenge we did our competition here. This is the reserve county high school battle. The Rogier was always in her community.
May it please the court. My name is Jim Rotenberry, counsel for petitioner. This morning, we will be splitting arguments between myself and Ms. Snelling. I will be addressing the 93-001 argument, and Ms. Snelling will be addressing the evidentiary issues involved in the underlying decision. Today, we have before us a court action arising out of a jail suicide situation. The record reveals that there was no indication that Mr. Ricardo Alvarado, at the time that he was jailed, was in any shape, form, or fashion suicidal. He subsequently, during his incarceration, committed suicide by hanging himself with a blanket in the prison jail cell. The case was tried to a verdict. The questions were submitted to the jury. The jury found that the city of Brownsville was not negligent in their conduct, and the trial court entered a take-nothing judgment in favor of the city of Brownsville. The Court of Appeals reversed that jury determination, finding that under their interpretation of Section 93-001 of the Civil Practice and Remedies Code, that it was improper to submit question number two, which was an inquiry as to the conduct of the person who committed suicide, and that the submission of question number two had caused confusion or misled the jury.
You say questions number two and three are immaterial in light of the jury's finding to number one?
That is correct, Your Honor.
And so we're left only with the evidentiary questions?
And actually, the Court of Appeals did not sustain point of error number one on the Court of Appeals level. They found that there was sufficient evidence to support the jury determination that the city of Brownsville was not negligent. Really, the only way that you can get to a reverse and remand for a new trial is to agree with the Court of Appeals reversals on the evidentiary rulings, because basically the Court of Appeals claimed that the evidentiary rulings precluded certain theories of negligence being presented to the jury, but they did find that the negligence finding was supported in the evidence. The no negligence finding was supported in the evidence.
It's not against the great weight.
That's correct, and that was in point of error number one. We would point out that the position that was relied upon at the Court of Appeals, by the Court of Appeals in their decision was not a basis for objection at the jury charge conference and was not a point of error that was raised on the appellate level. But this is a case of first impression before this court on what we believe to be the proper interpretation of 93-001. For the ease of court reference, I have distributed to you the provision of 93-001 that should be for you if you want to refer to the language. We believe that the proper interpretation of this affirmative defense that has been adopted by the legislature, which is entitled Assumption of the Risk, involves a two-pronged inquiry. The first inquiry stated prior to the semicolon in subsection A2 is, was the attempted or committing of suicide the sole cause of damage? It's important to, in our opinion, to refer to the word damage. In this case, the question would be, was the suicide of Ricardo Alvarado the sole cause of damage? And I would submit to this court that the answer to that question in this case is yes. If so, under this affirmative defense, the cause of action is barred. And then after the subsection, there is an exception to the assumption of risk bar, which is articulated. And I will get to that in just a moment. I believe that the proper interpretation of the statute prior to the semicolon is the classic assumption of the risk prong, which historically this court has emphasized that the focus in this defense is on the plaintiff voluntarily exposing themselves to a known or appreciated danger, which the classic situation is the suicide. It bars recovery when you sustain an injury knowingly and voluntarily. Um, we believe that there's been some confusion that's been articulated in reviewing certain summary judgment situations involving 93001. And that is because I believe that the inquiry of cause of damage is a completely different inquiry from the inquiry of the cause of the suicide. And I think it's best illustrated by giving an example. Let's assume that someone attempts to commit suicide, and this is a kind of a classic cry for help type suicide, where they are unsuccessful in their attempt. Emergency request is summoned to assist this person, either to pump a stomach or to assist them or to treat them in some shape, form, fashion. And then there is negligence in the providing of services, where it is clear that the person would not have died but for some negligence in the subsequent suicide attempt. That's why I believe you have to start with that first prong inquiry as to whether the cause of damage is the sole cause. In my example, the ER treatment after the attempted suicide would prevent that determination from being a sole cause. This interpretation...
But any time it's before, it wouldn't.
That's correct, Your Honor. But that gets to the second prong of the test, which I'll address as being the exception to the bar.
If the guard had come up and said, we're going to put you in a cell and you're going to be sorry you ever came to the city of Brownsville, there's no telling what's going to happen to you. You'd be better off being dead. And the guy got so despairing that he committed suicide. Under your interpretation of that first prong, the city would still have a defense. Because still, his cause of his damage...
I think under your hypothetical, what you would do is get to the second prong, which is the exception, which your situation is the classic situation which was articulated in the Supreme Court decision of Exxon versus Breachin.
How do you get past the first prong under your view?
If there is evidence that the defendant, by failing to abide by or comply with the applicable legal standard, was a proximate cause or a cause of the suicide event itself. You are suggesting that in that situation the guard was a cause of the suicide. And that is the exception to the rule when the suicide is the sole cause of damage. But the first inquiry has to be, was the suicide the sole cause of damage, or are there other causes of damage other than the suicide itself? That's what I'm suggesting in a two-prong analysis. We believe this is consistent with the legislative intent, which we have attached as Exhibit B, where the legislature said, we should establish as a public policy that plaintiffs should not be able to recover damages resulting from their own reckless or unreasonable behavior. So this is basically a restatement by the legislature of the assumption of risk defense, which has been classically adopted in Texas law. They go on to complain that the assumption of risk bar had been too limited, with onerous evidentiary burdens being placed on the defendant, and they meant to remedy this by adopting 93001. The second prong is a different inquiry. It is the exception to the bar rule, and we believe that the exception starts with the words provided, however, in subsection 2. The question in this inquiry is, was the suicide or attempted suicide caused in whole or in part by the failure on the part of any defendant to comply with the applicable legal standard? In other words, was the suicide caused, or did the defendant partially or totally cause the suicide? And this is where I believe that the case law has strayed in their interpretation of the wording, especially when the Fifth Circuit attempted recently in the Evans decision to apply Texas law in the situation in a case of first impression. It did not look to the rules of construction in the Texas law. Here, for liability to exist under the exception to the bar, I believe that you will have to have a duty, a breach of the duty, and proximate cause. Proximate cause being the focal situation here. The statute clearly does not eliminate the proximate cause requirement under Texas law. And it is our position that it is proper to plug in the general rule which this court recognized in Exxon versus Breachin in 1975. The general rule is that suicide constitutes an intervening force which breaks the line of causation from the wrongful act to the death, and therefore does not render the defendant civilly liable. That is the general rule that this court has adopted. It has never been changed, and certainly it is our position that the statute does not change that causation analysis. A good example is to refer to the example used in Appendix B, once again, in the legislative history, where the legislature says that it would be a bar when the evidence was that someone negligently sold a gun to a person, and then that person committed suicide by shooting the gun into their head. Now, to apply that to the statutory wording so that you clearly understand the legislative intent, it would be my position that the key here is the foreseeability factor, which is always a necessary element, if not the most important element, to the causation analysis. When you apply it to this case, it is our position that the city of Brownsville, not only was the evidence there to support the jury determination of no negligence, but we were entitled to a directed verdict, and we in fact moved for a directed verdict, but the court said it would look at that on the JNOV depending on what the jury's verdict was in the case. The reason being, there was no foreseeability in this case. The undisputed evidence was this gentleman was arrested in the afternoon. He was driving the vehicle, so he was arrested for being DWI because he had been involved in a single car accident. And so he was incarcerated mid-afternoon and placed into his cell. And the last time he was witnessed in the cell was around 6:50 p.m. And at 7:20, 7:25 p.m., he was discovered hanging in his jail cell using the blanket that had been on his bed. The undisputed evidence was there was absolutely no indication that he had any suicidal tendency whatsoever. He was not upset. He was not distressed. There were no outward manifestations of suicidal tendencies, and the family said that the man had never been treated psychiatrically. He had never had any kind of prior problems, and on the day in question, there was absolutely no indication that there was anything wrong.
How much time is left?
And I'll close up in just a minute, Your Honor. Because of that, we believe that we are entitled to a directed verdict. And this is a different result than a foreseeability situation where such as a hospital has voluntarily assumed the responsibility for protecting from suicide. And then
what's the standard of procedure when Brownsville incarcerates an individual? What do they do with their clothes? What do they do with their belts? What do they do with their shoestrings?
I'm not sure what they do with all those elements, Your Honor, and I'm not sure that came into evidence since this gentleman hung himself with a blanket that was on the bed itself. So I'm not sure what they did with his clothing. Ms. Nelly can certainly address from a record standpoint what
would
they did.
Would it make any difference if the jail takes on the duty when they arrest someone and incarcerate them to take precautions against the possibility of self-infliction of wounds?
It would certainly change the analysis when you're looking. If they've taken on the duty, then of course the next inquiry was, did they fail to comply with that duty, and if that was that failure a proximate cause of the injury in question. And of course, the final point that we make under 93001 is that in no event can you interpret this to eliminate comparative responsibility, which is what the Court of Appeals has suggested, that if somehow the defendant is 5% responsible for the suicide or a 5% cause of the suicide, it would be 100% responsible for the damages because you could not submit the contributory responsibility of the person who committed suicide. And we believe that that is an absurd and egregious interpretation of 93001. I will defer to Ms. Snelling at this point for the evidence discussion.
Justice Enoch, to answer your question, in the record, Jailer Perez was asked, and he stated that if it were known any overt suicidal tendencies were seen to where they would be apprised, that they needed to take precautions against a potential suicide person, they would even go so far as removing their clothes and not issuing a jail-issued blanket and stepping up the cell check. to take a precaution more often against the prisoner.
My question actually went to standard procedures. Now, I understand the evidence shows what they would have done and they thought, but aren't there standard procedures regarding articles of clothing as to all prisoners that are...
That was not in the record.
Okay.
Whether or not you remove their shoes first and what you do with them, no. Today I'm going to talk about the 8 evidentiary rulings and the time that I have that the Court of Appeals found that by virtue of the trial court's evidentiary rulings, it was reversible error. The first thing that I would note is on page 12 of the Court of Appeals opinion, they came out and stated that they were operating on the assumption that they were to liberally construe the use or condition of tangible personal property. And just recently, this court held in Kasmerson Hatley that non-use of property has never been the basis of a claim. And as we go through each of these points, we will see that unless foreseeability is in the picture, to have a causal nexus between the conduct of the employee and the condition of the property, what this is a non-use of property with total ignorance on the part of our jailers. The first...
Counsel, may I just ask you a preliminary question? Is it true that this case was tried generally on the theory that the jailers failed to perform the regular 20-minute checks of the jail cells?
Yes, it was, Justice Clark.
And is it true to say that all of the excluded evidence related to whether the case falls within the waiver of sovereign immunity under the Tort Claims Act, whether there was use of tangible personal property, whether it fell within the exclusion for police matters and that sort of thing. Is that correct?
That is correct.
And you contend those are factual matters that the jury decides whether it falls within the exception to sovereign immunity under the Tort Claims Act, or is that a legal question that the trial court decides when it renders judgment?
Are we talking on the basis of the evidentiary rulings made by the trial court, Your Honor, or are we talking about?
I'm asking whether it makes any difference that the trial court excludes some evidence which tends to show that tangible personal property was used in addition to the general theory of negligence in the case, or whether that's mainly a legal decision that the trial court makes when determining whether to render judgment on behalf of the plaintiff.
Well, all throughout our brief, and it's been our position all along, that when the objections were made at trial on either alternating method of providing police protection or discretionary decision, that was a legal ruling made by the trial court. There were some supplemental objections made along with it on relevancy grounds. So it becomes a fact issue, I suppose, on relevancy. If it's an abuse of discretion on the legal, yes, if it was an erroneous ruling as a matter of law. And on the first point, the failure to give CPR, that would be, the issue is whether or not it was an erroneous legal ruling. I could get into where it would be maybe an erroneous factual ruling if the court wanted to review the standard on that. They said that they preserved error on that in the Court of Appeals, but it was clear that their assertion that they weren't allowed to give evidence of Jailer Perez's failure to give CPR to Mr. Alvarado after he was pulled down did come in before the jury. It came in the back door when they were questioning Dr. Dong, the gentleman who did the autopsy. They went into extensively. And what did Mr. Perez say? Well, he said his eyes were fixed and dilated. There was no pulse. That usually indicates that death is irreversible. Where's the legal ruling? Is this a condition or use of tangible personal property? Again, unless there is some sort of foreseeability on Jailer Perez's part that he knew that Mr. Alvarado was going to go in there and use crossbars on a cell and a jail issue blanket as a hangman's noose, where is the causal nexus? The trial court was correct to make the ruling that it did in excluding that evidence. Your Honors, I'm just about to run out of time. I'll go to what the bottom line is on what the court held. They held that the 8 issues that we have addressed in our brief went to negligent training or negligent screening. This court, in State versus Terrell, said that you cannot attack or hold a county, a municipality liable on the basis of negligent formulation of policy. Each one of these issues was an attack on whether or not a policy was in existence or negligently formulated. This court also, in State versus Terrell, approved the holding in Resoria versus Radke. That case stands for the proposition that there can be no cause of action for negligent training. This court in New York said that forms are not tangible personal property.
Any other questions? Thank you, Kim.
Thank you.
Court is ready to hear argument from Ms. Martin.
May it please the court.
May it please the court, I'm Carter White. I represent Eugenio and Olga Alvarado, who are the respondents here. They were the appellants in the Court of Appeals and the plaintiffs at trial. Judge Enoch, you had a question regarding what the procedures are at the jail, and the jail procedures manual is exhibit 2 to defendant records. In the last volume of the statement of facts, there is not a specific shoelace belt requirement that are pretty commonly used in other facilities, but there is a specific acceptance by the city in that to provide for the safety of the prisoner, officers, and other persons as the reasons for processing. And there's some fairly specific types of things that are set out there in terms of strip searches and identification of the property. In fact, the shoes are kept in another place, but that's not in the record here. The regulations also, there's an acceptance of a duty for medical, it states in section 210, the health and well-being of prisoners in the city jail is the sole responsibility of the city. So contrary to what petitioner has represented to this court, the city has accepted that duty. Our position would be that it is the duty of anyone who is holding people in custody to provide its duty of reasonable care. Now, with regard to the evidentiary issue, and there are two issues which I hope to have time to address, but even if the court accepts the petitioner's argument or some type of a position either on section 93.001 or that the should have been a comparative type of a submission, this case still should be remanded for retrial because the trial court cut the heart out of plaintiff's case when it, in the Court of Appeals, granted 8 points of error and a 9th that had to do with cumulative error and excluding a host of our evidence that was relevant and specifically to this foreseeability issue. Now, York defines tangible as something corporeal, concrete, and with palpable existence. Lelue, reaffirmed by Kasson last week, said that use means to put into action or service to employ for or apply to a given purpose. There's just simply no question that in this case, the jail is not just the setting for the injury, as the school bus was in the earlier decision of the court. The city of Brownsville put the jail, the facilities there, into use for the purpose of detaining Ricky Alvarado. And the concrete step that's about 18 inches wide and 6 inches tall, which actually serves as the bed. There's not a bed in there. It's colloquially referred to as drunk tank. We call it a detoxification or detox cell. That step goes around two sides of the wall. It abuts the metal bars that are the front, that include the door. There are photographs of this in the record. And the step, the bars, and the jail blanket that was issued to the decedent are all corporeal, you can touch them, concrete, literally the floor is concrete, that step is concrete. They're all things that can be used, and obviously otherwise if they weren't, this young man wouldn't have died.
If we concede that you're correct, and thus that this falls within the waiver of sovereign immunity, how does that affect the judgment in this case if the jury went against you on the negligence submission?
Well, the jury didn't have all the information, and
well, how does your argument to the jury, perhaps, that this is tangible property that falls within the waiver of sovereign immunity affect their consideration of the factual issue of negligence in the case?
Well, because from the outset, if you accept that it is a case that falls within the waiver, then we should be allowed to present our evidence of the antecedent negligence that encompasses all of these eight items. There are specific items of the earlier suicide attempt, jailer Perez's preference to isolate inmates when possible. There was an extensive memorandum by Lieutenant Rios after the earlier suicide attempt the jury didn't get to hear about it. And that's negligence that involves, that directly bears on this individual jailer, who the cell check rule says at least every 20 minutes. It doesn't say 20 minutes on the dot. And in fact, their expert testified that it was better not to go in there every 20 minutes, because if somebody really wanted to hurt themselves, they'd wait and they'd know they'd have 20 minutes between cell checks. So it says at least 20 minutes. The fact that this young man was intoxicated, their own jailer, Perez, said that meant he should have been observed more frequently. 20 minutes it's probably more, but one jailer said 6:35 or 6:40, they did the cell check. One jailer said 6:50. The bookings don't start until 7:11 and 7:12. There were two individuals brought in. They violated their own regulations on booking multiple prisoners. They were supposed to do them one at a time. They decided to each book someone, and Jailer Elizondo, who another item that was completely excluded, had been written up for, quote, lack of responsible actions as a city jailer in responding to a higher authority. He was, by the personnel records that are in evidence as bill of exception and records only, he was a problem jailer, and he didn't do his cell check, and he decided to book these people, and they claim that there's a provision in that procedures manual which lets them give priority over booking, but it doesn't. It is not what that says.
But weren't you able, under the evidence that was admitted, to try your theory that there was an obligation to provide regular cell checks every 20 minutes or more often? And didn't you lose on that theory? And how would this evidence have, if admitted, made any difference?
It would have helped explain why what they got to put in front of the jury that booking was a priority. Well, this completely refutes that. This says Elizondo doesn't do his job. He doesn't go to training. He doesn't know CPR, and he doesn't follow the rules. Therefore, it casts doubt on something they offered as a defense. The fact is that Lieutenant Rios, in his memorandum, specifically cited the need for more training and more supervision. We were not able to get that in. We were not able to show that this suicide could have been prevented, and therefore it was foreseeable. We were not.
Excuse me, Ms. Wild. Following this train of thought, didn't the Court of Appeals conclude that the jury's failure to find negligence was not against the preponderance, the overwhelming preponderance of the evidence, weight of the evidence?
Of the evidence that the jury got to consider.
Okay. Now, you are arguing, are you not, that your bill of exceptions presented at the time of trial demonstrate that this non-finding was against the overwhelming weight upon the evidence, correct? That's what you are arguing now, is it not?
I'm arguing that it was error for us not to be able to present all of this.
And in doing so, you have to argue that the Bill of Exceptions demonstrates that this non-finding was against the great weight upon the evidence. Had the judge introduced that evidence, had he allowed that evidence in, this demonstrates there was harm in the outcome of the case because of the exclusion of the evidence.
Yes, sir.
But you have not challenged the CA's failure to consider those bill of exceptions on that issue, have you not? I mean, how do we, let's assume, I mean, where do we get to the point that we say, well, this excluded evidence should be admitted, and where do we then go to concluding that the case ought to be remanded? Don't we have to say, had that evidence been admitted, it would have produced a different result? That is, that this evidence, in fact, balanced against the evidence that was at the time of trial, would have demonstrated the non-finding be against the great weight.
I think the Court of Appeals did that. I think the Court of Appeals said that this, that the exclusion of this evidence probably caused the rendition of an improper judgment. And if I understand the question, then I don't agree that you have to do that. And I will concede that we have not challenged it here, but the Court of Appeals did both things. They found that the judgment was not against the great weight preponderance, but also held that the exclusion of all this evidence probably caused an improper judgment. The other items, though, the failure to provide CPR, that evidence did not come in the back door, as they contend. There was a brief mention of it, unobjected to, but we were not able to develop that at all. The way to handle this problem is with an instruction in the court's charge about what the tangible property is and what it isn't. The rules of evidence presume that relevant evidence should be admissible, and I suppose the trial court was trying to do its best to sort out from a relevant standpoint that certain things would not constitute tangible property. But if every memorandum is not tangible property, it's just information, this is gonna lead to great confusion in the trial courts of saying that the defendant will always object and say, well, Your Honor, that's a documentary piece of evidence. That shouldn't come in, tangible property. And these cases are going to continue to have these problems. Now, I wanted to address Section 93.001 because it has this two prongs that petitioner's talking about, the sole cause and the violation of the applicable legal standard. Now, as that relates to submission of a deceased's conduct in a death case, in a jail suicide case, if the jury answers the first question no, there's no liability anyway. And if they answer the question yes, then the submission is inappropriate because the conduct violates an applicable legal standard. That is the negligence standard of duty reasonable care. So there's really no reason at all if the section applies, and they're the ones that say and cite the provision in the law that it shall prevail over any other law. In fact, this law was passed. The comparative statute on comparative submissions was passed in special session after this, and I'm not sure if that shall prevail over any other law means any other law now in existence or not. But it is not nonsensical in light of this statute to have a comparative negligence charge to submit to the jury the conduct of the decedent in this case because
Counsel,
it's unnecessary. Yes,
I'm sorry. Counsel, are you conceding that but for what you contend to be the erroneous evidentiary rulings by the trial court, that given the fact that the jury answered question number one, no, that the city was not negligent, that questions number two and three are immaterial?
I don't concede that they're immaterial. I agree with the Court of Appeals that they caused confusion and misled the jury and focused the attention of the jury on some intentional conduct that was not relevant to the antecedent negligence inquiry, the antecedent conduct of the city.
So if the trial judge had let you introduce all the evidence that you're complaining that you were not able to introduce, and the jury had answered question number one, no, as they did here, you would not concede that question two and three are immaterial because of this confusion that was caused by these issues that really don't make any difference to the judgment.
Right. They focus on, I mean, Prosser says that, that comparing intentional conduct with negligence is problematic anyway, because it differs not just in degree but in kind. I will concede that the comparative statute appears to contemplate that type of a comparison, and I think this court still has to deal with that in interpreting the comparative negligence statute. But I think that, that any time when the jury goes back there, they're instructed to read the whole charge before they start to work. And the whole charge is read to them by the court before they even go back there. And they're looking at all the questions that they have to answer, and not just taking them.
You've been able to introduce all the evidence that you say you should have been. Are you saying that the presence of questions 2 and 3 caused the jury to answer question 1 no when they should have answered it yes? I'm trying to understand
yes,
what
that has to be our position, yes. It probably led to the improper.
And how do they answer the, how does it mean that they'll answer the negligence question no or differently? Just because there are other questions in the charge, I'm trying to understand that argument.
If the suicide statute says that if the city has violated an applicable legal standard, then suicide is not an affirmative defense. That first yes or no ends the inquiry, and they're not. If the answer is no, then the plaintiff loses. If the answer is yes, there's no reason to go on. There's no
your view of 93.001 is it doesn't say anything. If the city is negative, if the defendant is negative, then there's no reason to charge on suicide. And if the defendant is not negligent, then there's no reason to charge on suicide. So there's never a reason to charge on suicide.
I suppose that the sole cause requirement has to be a legal determination. Therefore, it would be one made by the court.
You would say the proviso applies if there's negligence.
Yes. That has to include common law duty.
So, if there's negligence, the proviso applies and you don't charge on suicide.
It's unnecessary to do so.
And if there's no negligence, you never get to call, so there's no necessity of charging on suicide. So there's never any necessity of charging on suicide.
It would be a legal determination. But if the court remands this case, the trial court is going to need some guidance on whether to do a comparative submission or to follow the suicide statute that says it prevails over any other law. And this is a very important issue. I wanted to just comment on a couple of other evidentiary matters which bear on the antecedent negligence of the city. The plaintiffs were not allowed to develop the city's voluntary acceptance of the jail standards commission rules, which were a standard that did not apply to municipalities at the time. They still don't, and that's a standard of care type evidence, which particularly as the Court of Appeals pointed out relating to the CPR and the failure to administer it, and that even comes in under the question that I believe Justice Heck posed earlier, where they're answering if there's some negligence in what happens after the suicide. There's not really a dispute here that when EMS arrived, they did administer CPR to this young man. And my time has expired, but the point of that was that there was evidence that was part of the harm. Thank you very much.
Any other questions? Thank you. And that concludes the argument in the second call. The court will take another brief recess.